I'm Catherine Spires, and this is Smart Mouth. We are on Instagram at Smart Mouth Podcast. There's a secret group on Facebook. You can search Smart Mouth, which is two words, to find it. And a huge thank you to Kimberly Camo for joining the Smart Mouth Patreon. And another huge thank you to Caitlin Hutchin for joining as well. And also thank you, Trillian Spencer, for increasing your Patreon level. That is so dope. If anyone else wants to jump aboard the Patreon train, it is at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast. My guest this week is Katie Parla, an expert in Italian food. She writes, she gives tours, and her new cookbook is called Food of the Italian South, Recipes for Classic, Disappearing, and Lost Dishes. I got a couple questions and comments about Italian food on the Google voicemail, which is at 209-566-2253. Here is one. It is about farinata.
Hi, this is Hannah calling from Washington, D.C., and my favorite Italian dish is something I had in Genoa. My sister, the summer after she graduated, we did a girls' trip after college. We had farinata, or I think socca in some other places it's known. Just this chickpea flour pancake thing. We had it was with a crapload of pesto on top. Best thing I've ever put in my mouth is like gooey and crispy, and I've never found it anywhere in the United States, and whenever I make it myself, it's always just not nearly as good. So my favorite Italian dish. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Hannah. I looked for farinata for you in the DC area and I didn't have any luck. It looks like one location of a pizza place called All Purpose in Washington, DC used to serve it. Maybe you can convince them to bring it back? For those who haven't had farinata, or socca, as it's called across the border in France, it's a sort of pancake made from chickpea flour. There are many variations of it, but it seems like it's most traditional to season it with salt, pepper, and rosemary. Our second question is about porchetta.
Hey, Catherine. This is Robert. I had some delicious porchetta in Rome, and I was hoping to learn some more about it. Also, is there any place to get good porchetta in L.A.? Thank you. I'm a big fan.
So porchetta is a skin-on, deboned pork roast stuffed with garlic, rosemary, whatever herbs you might have growing. Sometimes the pork liver is smushed in there, too, to give it deeper flavor. It's rolled up and cooked on a spit. In ancient times, it was actually cooked underground, luau style, so that's cool. It should be noted that porchetta is a prodotto agroalimentare tradizionale, which means, in Italian, traditional agricultural food product, which means it's not just food, it also has cultural relevance. That's a designation given by Italy's Ministry of Agricultural, Food, and Forestry Policy. Apparently, porchetta originated in the town of Ariccia, which is now sort of in the exurbs of Rome. And Philadelphia is probably the best city in the United States to get porchetta. But to answer Robert's question, in Los Angeles, there's a stall that pops up at markets around town. It's called Porchetta Republic. And you can find them on Instagram at Porchetta Republic. I haven't eaten there yet, but people go absolutely wild for its sandwiches. Also, there's Union Restaurant in Pasadena, and the first chef there was former Smart Mouth guest Bruce Coleman, and his porchetta was incredible. He's not there anymore, but the porchetta is, and they probably still use his recipe, so I bet it's still good. All right, on to the show. To Smart Mouth. This is Catherine Spires, and this week, I think for the first time, I have a guest with the same name. Doesn't go by it, though. Katie Parla. Hi.
Hello. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
We spell our names differently.
How do you spell it?
With a K and a Y.
With a Y. Okay. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. You're new. My family is so traditional with names. It's really weird.
Got that.
It was.
Very modern Catherine spelling going
yes,
on.
Yes. Yes, you do. So you do so many things. You're like, can I sum it up by saying an Italian food expert?
Okay.
You're okay with that?
Except.
How would you describe yourself?
I'm a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and mm-hmm. cookbook author.
Yeah, you've got a new cookbook out called Food of the Italian South.
Si. Oh. Super excited.
Do you live in Italy most of the time?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, Rome.
In Rome. Yes. You just said Rome-based. but like, I feel like by stalking your Instagram that you travel a lot.
I do travel a lot. I especially travel to Los Angeles and New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to be on the road.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Seems that way. And I've interviewed you before for a little article I did for LA Magazine about Roman style pizza.
Oh, yeah.
And what did we decide? That it's actually Bonchi style pizza?
So, I mean, we sort of talked about the various different Roman styles. Because, mm-hmm. like, unlike pizza napoletana, which is literally defined by a set of rules and regulations,
right.
Romans don't have that. And what they do have is multiple pizza styles. I would say there are three reigning pizza styles.
Three
in
of
Rome?
Them?
Yeah.
What were they?
Bonchi style is like the sort of third wave pizza mm-hmm. approach.
And that's named after a specific restaurant.
It's named after this dude called Gabriele Bonchi, mm-hmm. the most important pizza person, I think, in Italy. And he's really transformed pizza al taglio, pizza by the slice, mm-hmm. into an art form and created a gourmet product from something that is, for Romans, really utilitarian and really like just a snack food.
Right.
And he sort of turned it into more of a meal.
Mm-hmm.
While also like treating the dough in a much more sophisticated way.
I see.
And then we talked about like pizza al taglio actually being divided into two separate categories.
Yes.
So many words. Pizza alla palla is like the long slab one that you find in a bakery, and pizza uh-huh. in teglia is sheet pan pizza.
There are few cultures in the world more, not exactly obsessive, but like definitive about their food. Like
yeah.
There are some official rules and regulations, as you mentioned, but then people have very specific ideas about what is authentic or what have you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in Italy in particular, where there are so many rules that define how food is created and how it can be labeled,
mm-hmm.
That creates a sort of like lack of flexibility, which sometimes leads to a sort of the end of creativity,
right.
Which is why people like Gabriele Bonchi are interesting, because they're not following a specific like dogmatic approach
right.
to making food.
Yeah,
they're just sort of letting
sense.
The craft guide them. So
when I did study abroad in Rome, I had a horrible host family who wouldn't let me use the kitchen.
Gross.
So I ate one piece of pizza and one gelato cone every day. That's it.
I mean, that actually sounds like a silver lining story to me.
It was okay. And that was the first time I had had the whole going up to the counter and being like, I want this much of that. It took me a second to figure that one out.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not like a €2 slice
right.
culture. It's
yeah.
more like you choose the size of your portion and it's weighed and you pay.
Yeah. Choosing your own size of portion is also like, I don't think works as well in America because we're also ashamed of eating and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. So Chris Bianco wrote the foreword to
yes.
your book, and I don't want to give it away, but the experience that he talks about in that foreword, I had the exact same experience, like down to the same food item.
That's amazing.
I think it just goes to show, like, I sometimes like making fun of Italians for their rigidity, but also like they do have really good food that can change your life.
That's
for sure.
True. That's true. And I think, you know, like there are so many things in common between Italy and California.
Like what?
And that. Well, like the foreword, and don't want to like, you know, give too much away, but Italians don't just sit around eating like, you know, tubs of tiramisu and gelato all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Like their dessert is often fresh fruit
mm-hmm.
and like a single piece of chilled fruit served at like a summer meal
mm-hmm.
can be the most delicious thing you have.
Right.
Like that whole month.
Right.
And I mean, of course, California is huge and varied, but. You know, I'm reminded of like a meal that I had this August at Chez Panisse
mm-hmm.
where, you know, one of the desserts was like a bowl of grapes. So,
right.
And it's like, this is, we don't need to do any like type of adornment. This is like perfect as it is.
In Italy, is most of the produce that people eat actually grown in Italy?
Yeah, most of the produce is grown in Italy. The vast majority comes from Campania, Puglia, Calabria, and Sicily.
So the south part
the
of
south,
it.
The south, yeah, mm-hmm. exactly.
Okay. So I'm going to just ask you so many questions about South Italy.
I'm here for you.
I feel like I'm going to be Chris Farley and you're Paul McCartney
okay,
from that
let's
old
do
sketch.
This.
Okay. So your family wasn't exactly where you thought they were from.
Yeah, and I think that happens to a lot of Italian American
yes.
families where you're like, you're just sort of told you're from. Fill in the port city
mm-hmm.
of the south. Like
mm-hmm.
my family for literal generations always reported that they were from Naples because that's the port of departure. And it wasn't until maybe like 8 years ago that we discovered we were from 200 miles away, which is significant, especially if you consider that like my people left in like the later 19th century and they took animals or carts, maybe even walked to Naples. So my experience, you know, it's not unique. And my family, you know, landed in New York Harbor pre-Ellis Island and settled in first New York and then New Jersey and then promptly forgot its origins. And I think that's something that so many Italian Americans experience.
Okay. That's interesting. And I mean, this journey basically of 200 miles to finding like your ancestral town, do you feel like that made you feel more connected to Southern Italy?
That's such a good question. I actually already felt so connected.
Okay.
Because even though I had that like wrong information about where my family was from, I remember like when I was first in Rome, when I first moved to Rome 16 years ago, and I would go visit Naples, even though it was like a little scary and a little like the whole culture was very opaque to me and I didn't really get it, but I kept going until I loved it. So I was already like sort of indoctrinated into like the whole South Italy culture.
Is it like a thing where you forced yourself to go until you got it?
Absolutely.
Like that was a goal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
And like I was going in August and the streets were empty and hot and like, you know, every day was the hottest day of the year and people were crazy. And I didn't, you know, I hadn't mastered Italian yet. It was a very disorienting experience, but I was just like so committed to this like place. For really like arbitrary reasons, like I just got born to an Italian American family, like I didn't do anything to deserve Naples, but I was really dedicated to it. And now I really love it. And so like my travels in other parts of the region of Campania were really driven by that affection. And nothing, even though I'm not from Campania, my family's from Basilicata, it's nothing to diminish my affection for that region.
That's amazing. It's such a good place to explore. You're lucky that all these things came together for you to be able to focus on Italy.
Yeah, I mean, things just like align so that I could eat pizza professionally, I think.
Which is so wonderful.
It's pretty good.
So the thing about Italy as a country is that it's actually like kind of a relatively young country.
So young.
And also the unification of Italy. It took forever. It's so complicated. It went back and forth. All kinds of people said that they were the king. I kind of want to go into it, except for it takes too long.
We can do a crash course.
Do you have like the Cliff's Notes version?
Totes.
Okay, what is it?
Okay, so Italy was a number of divided kingdoms until the mid-19th century, when through military campaigns and diplomatic efforts, one kingdom, the House of Savoy, which was based in and around Turin, managed to unify most of what we would identify as Italy today. And that required a lot of people, a lot of time. It took decades. And although the last kingdom, which was the Papal States, where the Pope ruled from Rome, didn't fall until 1870, the rest of Italy was more or less under the king by 1861. And that's the date that Italians celebrate as their unification year.
But I've heard, isn't it true that it moved like a little bit around the borders in years after that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it wasn't until what, the 60s, until we have the sort of final iteration of Italy that we know today. 1960s. So yeah, I mean, like what I think is significant is that until 1861, everything basically an hour drive south of Rome, all the way to the toe and heel of the boot, was under Spanish dominion. So culturally, those areas, Molise and Campania and Basilicata and so forth, have a lot more in common with one another than they do with Lazio, which is where Rome is located, or for sure, like Piedmont or Lombardy.
Right, right. And it's always been the case that people who lived in the area that is now North Italy have always disparaged people who live in South Italy.
Yeah. I mean, poor Sicily, who has no one to shit on.
I know.
Being the southernmost region.
Oh, poor Sicily.
Aww.
I really like Sicily.
It's pretty good,
It's really interesting. So how is it that people, I mean, one of the like talking points of the Northern Italians who wanted unification, they would say stuff like that Southern Italians were barbaric and uncivilized and they needed the civilizing forces of the Northern Italians. Did that have anything to do with looking down on Spain as well? Or was it just fun for them to do? Was it straight up racism? Because there's that element of it too.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were a number of factors, and the South was super wealthy. Naples and Palermo were the richest, among the richest cities in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So any suggestion that the South was culturally backwards is simply like a, you know, regional racism, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a better term than that. Like the idea is that the South, because it was, you know, rich and agriculturally rich and culturally rich, it was a threat to King Victor Emmanuel II.
Got it.
The church was also really important in the South, mm-hmm. In terms of like real estate. So in order to debase the church, which is one of the many priorities of the unification government, a lot of the church lands were broken up.
Mm-hmm.
That led to widespread poverty and starvation. So if we want to talk about the South being, you know, backwards, I think that's overlooking the fact that the North like systematically deprived the South of property and food and economic plans, right, post-unification.
And that was by design, right? I mean,
absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so it definitely was, because they literally starved people out.
Yeah, I mean, now the system of agriculture in the South wasn't an ideal one. There was a lot of like indentured servitude, mm-hmm. a lot of landholders who had lots of farmers working for them, and those people were kept deliberately impoverished for, you know, class reasons. But we can point to a, you know, widespread starvation following the breaking up of those noble lands.
Right, right.
And 4 million people left the South.
That's a lot of people.
At the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah. Do you know who Emanuele Filiberto di Savoia is?
Emanuele Filiberto di Savoia?
Yeah. He's a prince, mm-hmm. of Italy. He's been on this show.
That's amazing. He was like exiled. His whole family was exiled from Italy until 2003.
Yeah. Yeah. And now he's back. And it turns out he's back with a vengeance, because in fall 2018, he gave an interview saying that he's really looking into trying to reinstate the monarchy.
There are tens of monarchists in Italy. Some of them hang out in front of Victor Emmanuel II's and Umberto I's tombs, and Queen Margarita's for that matter.
Cool.
And they collect
signatures.
Which
is Emanuele's grandmother.
Yeah, exactly. That's crazy. And I remember, like, the Savoys were exiled after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And not, like, I think not a lot of people know that King Victor Emmanuel III was actually in power with Mussolini. He didn't abdicate, although, like, of course he abdicated a lot of his responsibilities.
Right.
But in any event, the Savoys were booted out of Italy. And when they were finally allowed to come back in 03 or 04, one of the first sort of public acts was to have a marriage, and
his marriage,
Principe, got married in Santa Maria de Angeli,
yeah,
near the Termini station, and blocked traffic for like 17 hours in Rome. So that was like a real like, fuck you, Rome.
Oh my gosh. it was a power move.
Oh yeah,
that's,
you know, it
amazing. He also compared his nationalism to Trump's nationalism, like in a positive way.
Chill.
So that's something I didn't know when he came on this show.
That's really intense, man.
Yeah, it is. So you make a difference in your book between South and Southern Italy.
Yeah, I think South Italy, it's not just sort of my opinion, it's also the way that it's addressed in like Italian legislation, is the Lower Peninsula. And then Southern Italy is the Lower Peninsula plus Sardinia and Sicily.
Why the demarcation?
Italy is a place where like semantics rule. And you know, I think like the idea of a Southern culture might seem a little abstract, but you could argue that there is a sort of distinct feeling that vanishes when you go north of Campania and you start heading up into the northern parts of the peninsula. The culture changes, which makes sense because for most of the history of those areas, there was a series of, you know, conquests,
mm-hmm.
But very similar conquests, different from those in the north.
Do you have an opinion about the cultures? Is there one that you enjoy more?
Yeah, the South, man.
Yeah, I figured.
I mean, I do love the enthusiasm of like pork-drenched Emilia-Romagna, no doubt. But I'm most happy and most comfortable and feel, you know, the best when I'm in the Sannio or Pinia or Salento,
yeah,
all in the South.
So this is the anecdote that for me really crystallized how Italy how Northern Italians look on Southern Italians. And actually, Rome, I think some people like kind of dispute whether they're culturally Northern or Southern.
I think most people would say it's the South.
Okay. But Romans.
Romans have a different idea.
Yes. So when I was doing study abroad there, a girl who was also in the program, she hung her laundry off the balcony.
Did they call her Napolitana right away?
She got a note from the upstairs neighbor saying, "Non siamo a Napoli."
I'm not shocked.
Yeah. Which, by the way, means we are not in Naples.
That's so rude.
So rude.
No. Basta. Maleducata. Devo dire. Non c'è. Non si va. That's so rude.
Yeah. It's awful. And she just felt comfortable leaving that note and saying that about a whole city. And clearly, I think that kind of stuff usually comes from insecurity. So she probably knows that like people from Milan consider her Southern and it's a whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, what's so funny, too, is that Rome, as the capital, absorbed a lot of economic migrants mm-hmm. at the turn of the 20th century in the, you know, mid 20th century during the crisis of 09. So a lot of people in Rome are from the South.
Right.
But I don't think that, you know, prevents them from disparaging Naples and its affinity for hanging laundry in the street.
Is Naples just like the butt of a joke?
Yeah. Naples is a punchline often.
Yeah.
Which is like a totally superficial way to address that city.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, did you visit when you were...
Naples, I think I've only been to the train station, but I am reading Elena Ferrante's books.
Okay. So the Naples train station is what most people encounter, because when people go to Naples, they're typically en route to the Amalfi Coast or a cruise ship departure.
Yeah.
So what they see is Piazza Garibaldi, which is like garbaggio. It's so shit. And it's been under construction for years. Now there's kind of like a new mall, which doesn't feel Italian at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just like super generic commercial space. But like once you walk right past that, you're in like a pretty gritty zone, one that clearly is filled with decaying palaces and churches, like a place that used to be really maintained.
Yeah.
And now is in this like sort of period of decline. But then, you know, head up the hill and you're in like Vomero with these incredible views, and super posh, or Chiaia, which is luxurious. So there's more than one Napoli for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But when people are ridiculing Naples, they're usually making fun of the Centro Antico, the historic part of the city that was inhabited even before Rome.
I see. Huh. It's too bad that people think of them as a punchline.
Look, people need to recognize that Naples is amazing. They're starting to, I think, because like visitors to Rome, Venice, and Florence,
the big three
have never faced the crowds that we are encountering the past couple of years, and I think people are getting sick of it. And visiting Naples, which I do, you know, constantly, I've seen a lot more Anglophone tourists.
That's interesting to hear that that's like a general feeling, because the last time I was in Rome was, I think, 3 years ago, and I thought I was gonna die from mm-hmm. the crowds. And I'm not an agoraphobic person, but it was so cramped.
Yeah. It's
and
not great.
Rome's not like a huge city. So to have all those people, it's different than that number of people coming to LA all at once.
Yeah. I mean, and Rome does a much better job of absorbing visitors than Florence, which is microscopic by comparison.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, it's bad. So like, don't visit Rome. It's too crowded. Florence is trash and Venice is crazy. So go to Naples and Bari instead.
Well, apparently these Elena Ferrante tours are a whole industry unto themselves.
I bet. Yeah.
And they're going into the neighborhoods that she wrote about, which were not like
that's cool.
tourist places. And they're all just baffled why anyone would come there.
That sounds cooler and probably a lot safer than the Gomorrah tour. Don't know if you've caught that series.
No.
But like, okay, so it's a series about the Camorra, which is the Campania-based mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some like really, you know, some of the few like truly dangerous places of Naples are in there. And like, you've got all these like rando tourists going to look at these gigantic dilapidated housing projects with like very open violence in the streets. And it's like, this is not a theme park. This is like a neighborhood. It's gross.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That kind of reminds me of the people, I think this has died down, but a few years ago, going to Detroit and getting tours of all the condemned buildings was a thing.
That's rude.
I agree. So I think that from the outside, Italy may seem homogenous, which we've kind of disproven a little bit even in our conversation so far, but the Mediterranean has always been such a busy place. Like, as soon as people figured that they could float on a piece of wood, everyone there has been like moving back and forth.
Yeah, for sure. And because it sticks out into the Mediterranean and is touched by various seas, the lower peninsula of Italy has been colonized, conquered, and disputed by tens of civilizations. You know, like Naples and Bari and Reggio Calabria were, you know, pre-Roman cities, places that were founded by Greeks and Carthaginians who were, I wouldn't say welcomed, but who encountered local tribes when they got there.
Right. And it seems like the Arab invaders, conquerors.
Yeah, conquerors.
People had particularly enormous influence on the culture of southern Italy.
Yeah, I mean, definitely from two major perspectives that are related, irrigation and agriculture.
Yeah.
So like the variety of plants, the types of plants that could grow, where they could grow, were really influenced by the engineering of the conquerors who are coming from North Africa and introducing all sorts of, well, hydraulic engineering and things that still function today.
Yeah.
If you visit Palermo, which used to be like very desert-like, there are these, they look like oases almost, filled with palms and fruit orchards. And that's because the canal system of tapping a water table at a distance and then bringing the water in underground, like tubes carved out of the living rock at a constant low grade angle still work. They're from the 9th century.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that is so cool. Dope. I had no idea. I did go to Palermo, but I wasn't paying attention to the water.
Yeah. It's awesome. It's pretty rad.
Yeah, I only went there when I was 18. I'm sure I would have a much more intellectually fulfilling time if I went now and actually like looked at stuff. Yeah.
And you know, I named Palermo, but you could talk about, you know, any part of the South where essentially like the areas where the Spanish were kicked out in 1861, like that whole swath of the South Peninsula, like had, you know, almond paste recipes introduced, and they're still produced today.
Yeah.
Citrus, candied citrus in particular, because South Italy didn't have sweet citrus until the Renaissance. It was a lot of bitter citrus. And so like the sort of transformation of something bitter into something sweet was another one of those factors. The use of spices and the availability of a really diverse range of spices also dates back to that time.
There is something that you briefly noted in this cookbook as well. You were like, Calabrians like spicy, but like Italian spicy.
Yeah, it's relative.
Yeah. which is like Chinese spicy. It's not Mexican spicy.
I mean, you still, if you're into heat, you still have to BYOP. Bring your own pepperoncino. That's so corny. I apologize. That's very cheesy, but also I'm going to keep using it. Yeah, like New World produce, including hot and sweet peppers, squash, legumes, were transported from the New World to the South of Italy because that was Spanish territory.
Right.
So it only makes sense that new specimens were introduced. And, you know, the Calabria, which is the toe of the Italian peninsula, just it's known for its really bold and strong flavors, whether that's pepperoncino, which is, you know, relatively spicy by Italian standards, onions, licorice, those things are now considered indigenous to that region.
Yeah. And I was thinking about how, to a certain extent, eggplant, but definitely peppers and tomatoes, I think are so associated with Italian food. But maybe, I mean, so those plants are relatively new.
Yeah, from the Renaissance.
Right.
16th century.
Yeah. And then they become maybe more popular in Italian-American cooking than actual Italian cooking?
I mean, it remains a regional thing, right? So eggplants, peppers, different types of squash, tomatoes, those are really typical of the cuisine of South Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Logically, Italian-American cuisine is influenced by the South of Italy because that's where most people came from when they escaped the poor economic conditions. So yeah, now when you think of Italian food, you always think of like eggplant parm or spaghetti sauce with tomato. And now you can certainly find those things all over Italy, but they're native to the South. But I would also add that tomatoes were late to be adopted in a widespread manner in the south of Italy. That, you know, the species were started to be introduced in the 16th century, mm-hmm. but they weren't embraced until much later, even the 18th or 19th century.
So it took a while for them to. Yeah. You had another. Is it true that a lot of Italians at first had like slight allergic reactions?
Yeah, they're part of the nightshade family. Mm-hmm. People had allergic reactions to them. Franciscans and others preached against them because they were like very plump and round and soft and too erotic. Oh,
yes, so sexy.
Yeah, very sensual. So yeah, they were considered sort of the fruit of the devil.
Love it.
Too tempting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we, even in America, it's kind of gone out of favor, but calling a girl a tomato.
Really?
Yeah.
I was not aware of that.
It's a pretty old school term. But I guess I never really thought about the reasons. But yeah. Now that you've like put Catholicism in my brain, I was like,
yeah, there you
right,
go.
Of course. So tempting and soft. Gross. So the idea is Italians just like got used to them, like exposure therapy kind of.
Yeah. And I suppose they're like quite, over the course of like many generations, susceptible to improvement or mutation, or mm-hmm. people just get used to eating what they have around them because they're starving.
Yeah, that'll do it. That'll definitely do it. Although, so you thought you have this theory that potatoes are more important to Southern Italian cuisine.
Yeah, I mean, tomatoes are definitely fundamental, but potatoes really historically delivered and continue to deliver an important caloric. Oh my God, what's the English word for it? They deliver calories. Okay, whatever. Change up my words. Yeah, and if you look at, like, breads would be enriched with potatoes. Sweets would be enriched with potatoes. Potatoes were a festive food. Things that you would eat a lot of on the pre-holiday days. So, like, before you had to have a lean Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, in you know, we've got to remember that in the South, a lot of people worked really difficult agricultural jobs.
Yeah.
And they literally just needed calories.
Right.
Potatoes were a good delivery system for that.
Yeah.
You also can store them. They last a long time, unlike fresh tomatoes, which mm-hmm. need to be consumed or transformed into sauce.
And a lot of Albanians
in
Southern Italy. This is something that I truly had no idea
about. It's amazing to think that in the 15th century, entire Albanian villages were evacuated. People were fleeing Ottoman expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And landing in various parts of the south,
mm-hmm.
Especially Calabria, but also Molise and Puglia. And it's kind of amazing. If you drive along the Salento coast, south of Lecce, the very heel of the Italian boot, you can tune your radio to Albanian stations. Because Albania's not that far away.
Right.
But culturally, it's very far away, particularly because of the closed nature of the country until quite recently.
Right.
But 1450, 1480, you have these tribes coming over and settling in villages where a dialect that's much more closely related to a 15th century Albanian language than 21st century Albanian language still spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like the foods are still preserved, the dress is still preserved, and even the way that like chimneys are built on the outsides of buildings.
Oh, wow.
Which is unique to the sort of mountain villages in central Albania.
Uh-huh.
Is reproduced to this day.
Do they consider themselves Italian?
No.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. There's the whole Arboresh culture. So people would identify first as Arboresh and then as, like, you know, they would have Italian passports, of course.
Yeah.
They would speak Italian.
Okay.
You know, maybe even wear like Gucci sunglasses, whatever. But like the language that's spoken at home, the traditions, the way that Easter is celebrated, you know, a lot of holidays, family units all really are connected to now a 600-year-old tradition.
Are Italians nice to them?
In the sense that like a lot of the Calabrian villages are now like tourist attractions for Italian travelers who want to go and sort of encounter this culture. I think for a lot of Italians, particularly in the increasing like xenophobic state that we're living,
mm-hmm.
They feel safe. Whereas like modern, like more recent Albanian refugees to arrive, especially in like the 80s and 90s, were demonized.
Oh.
To call someone Albanese is kind of a slur.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's gross.
Huh. That's interesting. Although I guess I'm not totally surprised. I feel like Italy hasn't really come to terms with its multi-ethnic background.
No, they're very content to consider themselves like of pure blood, whatever that means.
Right.
And to instantly disparage whatever new arrival is coming for whatever reason.
Yeah, I know Sicily is a little different, but culturally, but it's part of Italy. And one of my sisters lived in Sicily for a year, and she said that things could get almost violent if she suggested that they were North African.
Oh, yeah, because Italians on the peninsula say you need a passport to get to Sicily and that it is Africa, which is not meant to be a positive statement.
Right. Isn't that wild?
But like if you go to the port cities in particular of the South, people like you will see African migrants hanging out with locals,
mm-hmm.
Which is not something that you find in Rome or Milan.
Right.
There really is much more open-mindedness and openness, especially at those port cities, which historically have, received people from all over the world.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Does anyone in Rome eat Chinese food?
Yeah.
Everybody?
Yeah, I would say everybody.
Okay, so that's something that has changed.
Yeah, andare al cinese is code for, like, let's go eat some diluted version of a Chinese dish that costs €3.
Okay. All right. So it's like a easy dinner out.
Yeah, it's expected to be very cheap. It's expected to be barely seasoned. So I wouldn't call any of the most popular places in Rome that locals would go for Chinese cuisine.
Yeah.
Passable or capable of edible food in any way.
Oh God.
But there are a few places that are for Chinese immigrants where you can eat really well.
Uh-huh.
Clearly the clientele reflects who's eating where.
I see.
Yeah, there's like a super famous place in Rome called Sonia that like all my Roman friends are obsessed with. And I'm like, you guys, this is not food. This is just kind of like white rice with like starch around it. Like, what are you even talking about?
You're not even like, this isn't Chinese food. You're like, it's not food.
This isn't food. It's not acceptable.
Do you go to the places that cater to Chinese people?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Are those as good as you can get in California?
No.
Okay.
But they're pretty. They're fine.
They're more. It's food.
It's food. It's food. It's food.
It's actual food.
Yeah. No, there is like a lot of, I would say like a ton of Mexican places that will say like Mexican food on like the exterior,
mm-hmm.
that are serving something you might recognize as, you know, being a dish from various parts of Mexico.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't found anything that's like truly satisfying.
Right.
And it's not cheap to go out to like whatever Mexican spot. And with increasing frequency, the Mexican places are also serving like pancakes and poke and all sorts of random,
just kind of like Americana,
yeah.
American trends.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a bagel in the mix.
France is having a bagel moment. Has that gone over to Italy too?
There are some bakeries that are serving bagels, uh-huh. or they call them bagels, but I wouldn't.
And you're from the East Coast, so you have opinions,
yeah.
about it. Are they too big to be real bagels?
They're like not the right texture or flavor, and it's just round bread with a hole in it.
Oh, okay. That would be disappointing if you really want a bagel.
Yeah. I would highly recommend when traveling through Italy to mm-hmm. go to bakeries and avoid bagels, but also eat like all the cool stuff that might just be unique to that specific town.
Yeah.
Like go to Matera. If you really like to eat bread, like go to Matera or Altamura, where bakeries have been making durum wheat loaves with local grains for centuries. That's where it's like, you know, fun to eat bread, not at the like American themed bakeries.
Right.
In Rome.
Right. No, it wouldn't be. And I think a lot of people still don't even consider a lot of the places that you talk about in your cookbook as a vacation destination. And they are harder in the sense that not as many people speak English as in the bigger cities in the north, but I think they're gorgeous. Puglia is amazing.
Yeah. Puglia is great. And I would say that because of the economic crisis of 2009,
mm-hmm.
a lot of young Pugliese people, Calabresi people went to the UK,
mm-hmm.
or went to Germany, went somewhere, and English became the language that they communicated in. So you will find some English speakers.
Okay.
No doubt. Just certainly not the the density that you might find in a more developed touristic destination. And the South is really, really fun for traveling, especially if you don't have like a checklist in mind. Like if you need to see 40 museums in a day, like Naples is going to do it for you, but Matera's not. I love traveling like to Bologna. I love Venice. I'm really into it. Not such a fan of Florence, but that's fine. But I don't have that sense of like discovering something when I go to those places. Whereas if I get in a car and drive through Cilento, I feel like I'm discovering the Amalfi Coast 300 years ago. Or if I'm going to the Sannio or Irpinia districts in Campania, you're just like, you just like kind of want to shout out your window, like, where is everybody? Like there are, there's so much grain here and like all these crazy fields and farms, but there are no visitors here to appreciate it, which is unfortunate. But I think, you know, if this book can do anything, I hope it inspires people to leave a checklist at home, rent a car with full insurance coverage, and then just like go travel. And you can see cool stuff. Like Matera is a cool place to visit. It looks like a nativity scene. It's like a rock hewn place that's been inhabited since Neolithic times. Pompeii's in the south. Go look at that. Right. And then go somewhere else that's not as crowded. Right. Herculaneum, for example. But there's definitely a lot of, there's a lot of history. You've got to drive often long distances between places, but I mean, the scenery is, I think, worth it.
And the food.
Of course. Of course, certo.
There was only one recipe in your whole book that gave me pause, and I want to talk to you about it.
Okay.
Chocolate-covered eggplant.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, that's just, I can recognize the difference between me initially being like, ooh, I don't know, versus me. It's not like I wouldn't try it. I was just like, oh, goodness.
It's like one of those dishes that people say is like, è particolare. Like, it's strange. But it's, I think it really speaks to like the way that in the South, people just like, they're like, it's August, we've got a party, we've got a lot of eggplants, and we've got some chocolate. Like, let's make something happen. And yeah, the eggplants are deep fried and they're like dipped in chocolate and studded with candied citrus. And this is a really typical, oh, also like soaked in liquor, just in case you.
Oh, that kind of makes, it kind of makes it make
just
more
gives
sense.
You a little boozy kick. And like, frankly, I included it because it had a really interesting story to tell.
Yes.
Like, and I always sneak in a few recipes that I know not everyone's going to make.
Sure.
And that will be their choice. But several of the event venues that are hosting book tour events are like, we're just going to send this out like for free at the end of the night. And like, if people like it, great. If not, no big deal.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Nice compromise.
Well, I think that the people who listen to this podcast will like this book, Food of the Italian South, also because you do get into the history. You learn a lot. And the pictures are really pretty. And frankly, like lots of times cookbooks, not everyone can expect to make every recipe in them. So it's good when there's good photos.
Yeah.
Get something to look at.
Yeah. Shout out to George Dolese, my food stylist, and Ed Anderson, the photographer. And like the dishes are simple. They're easy. Mm-hmm. They're delicious with the possible exception of the eggplant chocolate dessert.
Do you have a favorite pasta dish in the book? Or are they all your babies?
My favorite is garbage can pasta. For lack of a better translation.
That's an interesting choice as well.
Yeah. Sicchi da Munez is the dialect of like the northern part of Mount Vesuvius for trash can. And so garbage can or trash can pasta is spaghetti that's tossed with the tomato sauce in which capers, pine nuts, walnuts, and raisins have been simmered in a lot of oil.
Yeah.
And the term garbage can sort of comes from the idea that after holiday meal preparation, particularly Christmas holiday preparation, you've got like all this random bits hanging around, and one way to make use of it is to throw it into a pasta sauce and, you know, whip together something really quickly, because if you're preparing something around the holidays in Campania, it's likely that you've had to spend like 14 hours doing it, so having something quick is always a good thing.
Well, it's a great book.
Thank you.
Where can people find you on social media and whatnot?
I'm at Katie Parla on all the social networks, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. My website, katieparla.com, has my tour schedule, and that is all.
Perfect. Well, Katie, thank you so much.
Grazie. Tintarella di luna.
gatto, sopra il tetto come i gatti, e se c'è la luna piena, diventi candida, tintarella di luna. Candida.